Central Time on the Ideas Network. I'm Lee Rayburn, and coming up, the federal government seized two banks that collapsed over the weekend, and we'll check in on the Biden administration's response and what it means for your money. But first, the New York Times reported earlier this week on a 2022 survey from the National Education Association. It found that 55% of educators surveyed say they were considering leaving the profession altogether. That's more than half. Why is it more than half? Is it the pandemic? Is it the politics, the parents, the pay? And what do teachers have to say about all this? I'm asking. You can join our conversation at 1-800-642-1234. If you are a teacher, what's it like in your classroom today? Or if you're a parent, what do you see from your teachers? If you are a student, you can join us too at 1-800-642-1234 or post on the Ideas Network Facebook page. You can always email us as well, ideas@WPR.org. Our guest has spent a lot of time hearing from teachers about all of these things. Alexandra Robbins is an author of 5 New York Times best-selling books and a Goodreads nonfiction book of the year. Those books include The Overachievers, The Secret Lives of Driven Kids. Her new book came out just yesterday. It's The Teachers, A Year Inside America's Most Vulnerable, Important Profession. Alexandra, welcome to Central Time.
Thanks so much for having me.
So let's start with that National Education Association survey from last year. It found that 55% of educators were considering leaving their profession. What's your reaction to that?
That number might actually be low. The morale among teachers is extremely low right now. And it's not just because of the pandemic. The issues in the education system started before the pandemic. It's just the pandemic exacerbated them, and the treatment of teachers has gotten worse.
So it's not just the pandemic then. So what were these issues before the pandemic that teachers were seeing that were driving them to consider leaving the job?
Sure. Well, teachers are incredibly hardworking professionals who work an alarming number of hours unpaid, but instead of our gratitude and a proper salary, they're getting disparaged and demoralized. Right now, the teacher pay gap has hit a record high. U.S. teachers earn 24% less than professionals with similar education and experience. That's demoralizing. Then you have a job where district officials and sometimes principals pile on extra responsibilities onto teachers without giving them the resources, support staff, or planning time to do that within their paid contractual hours. So teachers are working late into the night, almost every night, trying to get their job done.
And yet at the same time, as you write in your new book, the teachers, they often have to take on secondary jobs just to pay the bills.
That's right. So I followed 3 teachers for a year to make it sort of an interesting behind-the-scenes story with characters whom readers would work for. One of those teachers, Penny, she was an 18-year teaching veteran, an award-winning teacher, and she was making $47,000 a year. And she couldn't live on that. She had 2 extra jobs.
And there are 2 others that we'll get to, but we should also mention, Alexandra, that you were a substitute teacher as well. How did that experience suit you?
So it's interesting. I see what teachers mean by they love teaching, but they do not love being a teacher. The act of teaching is beautiful, just connecting with students and colleagues and having this mutual learning and growing experience and impacting their lives and seeing them make connections. There's just joy and exhilaration in that. You know, I grew up playing sports and I've experienced runner's high during sports, but teacher's high is way better. However, I subbed almost the whole year. I subbed more than 150 days out of 180. And for the whole year, including almost a semester spent as a full-time third grade teacher, I made $17,000. So I understand what teachers are going through.
Wow. And you write about this in your book. And here's a quote I've got highlighted. Making joy happen is a driving force unlike any other I have ever experienced. So when we talk about why teachers stay, this has to be at least one of the big underlying reasons, Alexandra.
They stay for the students. Absolutely. They leave because the adults. It's true. They leave because of administrators. They leave because of district officials. They leave because of parents. Whoo, you want to talk about parents? That's a whole other show.
So introduce us to the 3 teachers that you shadowed for a whole school year. And I think you mentioned Penny, who was an 18-year teacher who was making less than $50,000 as a 6th grade math teacher.
Yes, she was a math teacher in the South. I followed Miguel, a Western special ed teacher who was fighting to save both his school and the special ed program that his school board was trying to destroy, and Rebecca, an East Coast elementary school teacher. Now, Rebecca, she hadn't had a date in 5 years because her work was all-consuming, and her boyfriend had even broken up with her because he said she was spending so much time at home working on teaching rather than paying attention to him. So I followed her the year she tried to get back into the dating pool to see if she could teach and have a work-life balance at the same time.
Yeah, and she couldn't.
I'm not going to spoil it for anyone. It's a story that we follow, and you know, the ups and the downs and the maybes.
And I got it. You start the book with the start of a new school year, and I got that feeling of the anxiety, but the excitement of the start of a new school year. And as you detail, it's not just the students that feel that way; it's the teachers as well. They get excited for this school year, and then you go through the school year in your book month by month, and it's just. It sounds like such a challenge to just get back to that making joy that is such a cause or reason for teachers to do what they do.
And you know what one of the hardest months of the year is? Right now, March. Some teachers call it Death March because it's like this long slog with no break or holidays.
Yeah, that sounds about right. How big of an issue do you see perception versus reality being here? The work of teachers and public opinion or even portrayal in the news media compared to what you saw and what you experienced in your work for this new book?
The public has no idea what teachers really go through. That was the point of the book. I want the public to be aware of educators' unacceptable working conditions. This wouldn't be tolerated in any other job. We dump so much stuff on teachers. But yet I also wanted the public to see the joys that teachers feel and just how much teachers go above and beyond for, they call them their kids. They don't call them their students. I interviewed hundreds of teachers across the country, and they all said, "My kids." And that's how they really feel.
Alexandra Robbins, our guest. She is the author of the new book, The Teachers, A Year Inside America's Most Vulnerable, Important Profession. Just this week, the New York Times listed it as one of 19 works of nonfiction to read this spring. And here's another quote from the book that stuck with me that you were speaking about, Alexandra. Teachers are the country's silent, constant superheroes, and that's a big problem. They shouldn't be our superheroes, you write. Why?
Because what has happened is that teachers have become, as I said, the dumping ground. It's like all of society's failures, all of the government's failures rest on teachers' shoulders. And I'll give you a sort of a somber example of that. The only thing that changed between the 2012 Sandy Hook massacre and the 2022 Robb Elementary School massacre was that teachers were trained to hide their students and barricade the door. Nothing else really changed substantively in society. So this is an example of teachers having to bear the weight and responsibility for society's failures. We saw in the pandemic that public schools were having to feed children because the government wasn't taking care of them. Again, we had to go to teachers and school staff to feed food insecure students. It's like everything comes down to teachers, and they're not being paid for it.
Going above and beyond on a regular basis. So you also talk about, and I think this is towards the end of your book, Alexander, about the catch-22 that the education system itself finds itself in with, you know, a void for teachers, the need for teachers, an education system that would need to change in order to get more teachers. So what comes first? How does the education system change to accommodate a teacher being able to afford to live and do what they love?
Yeah, the job has to change. First, higher pay for teachers. And I don't mean that glibly. Studies actually show that students' math and English scores are significantly higher in districts that have higher base salaries for teachers. We also need more support staff, more counselors, aides, paraeducators, and a full-time nurse in every school. And most of all, we need a job that can actually be managed during teachers' paid contracted hours at school rather than bleed late into the night unpaid.
Mm-hmm. We're talking with author of 5 best-selling New York Times books, Alexandra Robbins, about her new book, which came out yesterday. It's called The Teachers, A Year Inside America's Most Vulnerable, Important Profession. It follows 3 teachers throughout the school year, and we want to hear from you at 1-800-642-1234. What questions do you have for our guest, and what's resonating with you here? What strikes a chord? Whether you are a teacher, a student, a parent, administrator, the custodial staff, it all goes into making it happen every day in the classroom. How are the connections with the teachers and the parents? What do you see from where you sit today about education in America right now? Join us, 1-800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234. We'll continue this conversation coming up on Central Time. This is Central Time on the Ideas Network. I'm Lee Rayburn, and we're picking up our talk with the author and reporter Alexandra Robbins. Her new book, The Teachers, A Year Inside America's Most Vulnerable, Important Profession. And we want to hear what you think about your teachers today, past, present, 1-800-642-1234. And if you're an educator in the classroom, share what you see. 1-800-642-1234. Have you considered looking for another job elsewhere? What is it that keeps you with these kids? You can also email us, ideas@WPR.org, or share your observations on our Facebook Ideas Network Facebook page. And what about the politics of teaching today, Alexandra? Where are the perils in that?
Well, we live in a very strange time. We live in a time where certain politicians are pushing to censor teaching and classroom discussions of race, racism, gender, and LGBTQ issues. They're galvanizing parents by packaging these measures as parents' rights. However, this does not include all parents. Their messages of exclusion and bigotry pander to only a certain small subset of parents. And what this has done in the education landscape is there's been sort of a targeting of teachers who are sort of caught in the middle of the things that they know actually happened in U.S. history, or the things they know they need to teach, or the things that students need to confide in trusted adults like teachers and guidance counselors, and the politicians who are saying, well, no, you can't. And I'll give you examples. A New Hampshire parent group offered a bounty for anyone who caught a teacher talking about racism or sexism in schools, I think $500. A Pennsylvania elected official, a state representative, told right-wing parents to become substitute teachers just so they can spy on other teachers. This is a pretty intense anti-teacher sentiment that not only makes this one of the most difficult times to be a teacher, but also is part of this large national movement attacking public schools.
Yeah, Christina on our Facebook page wrote a challenge they see teachers facing is censorship by the political right. But it's being the way it's we read about it is a parents' bill of rights. The parents have a set of rights when it comes to their child's education. How do you balance those in the classroom?
Well, you know, I think parents have the right. I'll give you an example. Let's talk about the books. Yeah. Parents have the right to monitor what their own child reads if that's how they want to parent. But they do not have the right to control what all children read. So parents, instead of just saying to their child, you know what, I don't want you to read a book about XYZ, they're saying ban the book entirely, take them out of the library. And worse, now they're talking about pressing charges against school librarians or teachers who have those books in their classrooms and make them accessible to students.
I'm glad you mentioned school librarians, because this is a part of your new book, The Teachers. Alexandra, talking about the role that school librarians play and specialist teachers play as well, and how those often seem to be the first things to be cut when it comes time for budgeting for education.
Librarians are extremely underestimated. Students are actually more likely to graduate, master academic standards, and score higher on tests if their school has a full-time qualified librarian. However, 40% of K-12 schools don't have a full-time librarian, and nearly a third of school districts in our country don't have any librarians at all. We need them. They're central to student success.
Mm. Alexandra Robbins, our guest, the author of the new book, The Teachers, A Year Inside America's Most Vulnerable, Important Profession. You're welcome to join the conversation. Tell us what you see from where you are today at 1-800-642-1234. And the book details the lives, 1 year in the life of three teachers. And one of those teachers is Miguel, who you mentioned before, a middle school special education teacher. But I also become invested in some of these students that these teachers have in their classroom every way. And one of those that stuck out to me was the relationship Miguel had with Eli in his classroom through the school year. Can you share a little of that with us, Alexandra?
Yeah, Eli had a bad reputation in school. Prior educators had said, well, he comes to school late or he doesn't come at all. And then every year, regularly, he would bolt from the classroom for no reason. And so Miguel started the year saying, he told me, he said, I'm going to treat Eli like the student I want him to be rather than the student that I heard that he was. And he did. He just exuded such a warmth when Eli came to the classroom. When Eli came in, 2 hours late, Miguel wouldn't say anything about being late. He'd say, hey, Eli, I'm so glad you're here. It turned out Eli was homeless. So Eli was dealing with so many more challenges than meets the eye. And Miguel's hard work with him was a really inspiring story to follow.
Yeah, these classrooms don't happen in a vacuum. And you detail this in no uncertain terms in your book, the teachers, that it's part of the context that are part of the lives of the teachers and the students. But that classroom is so, indelible. I can still remember all the names of my grade school teachers, and they've all become a part of who I am today. So they don't happen in a vacuum. But do we recognize that as the role that these schools play in the lives that these kids have?
People aren't thinking about that. They're not thinking about the teachers. And there are so many teachers who told me they do this when their kids are at recess. The teachers buy food. And when the kids are at recess, they stuff backpacks of food insecure children with the food so that they know that at least their family will have something to eat. Teachers are doing this, paying out of their own pocket. 94% of teachers pay for their own classroom supplies out of pocket, an average of $500 a year. Penny once spent $2,000 in a year. And part of that is looking out for kids who can't afford things.
Penny is one of the three teachers you detail in your new book, The Teachers, A Year Inside America's Most Vulnerable, Important Profession. I have to ask you, out of curiosity, after reading the book, did you find the three best teachers in America? Or are these just indicative of what you find in any classroom, in any school, everywhere?
Any classroom, any school, anywhere. I there are so many teachers I could have followed. I interviewed hundreds. So many would have had great stories. I chose Rebecca, Penny, and Miguel because I knew that readers would both relate to their stories and find them captivating.
Let's go to your questions and comments now at 1-800-642-1234 with our guest, Alexandra Robbins. Camille in New Berlin, you're on the air.
Hi, thank you for taking my call. Can you hear me correctly?
Yeah.
Okay, good. Yes, putting more money into the schools. First of all, I was a teacher for over 30 years. I served 5 years on our local school board. If putting more money into the school means that superintendents can create new positions like assistant superintendents, more directors of curriculum, these are two-year contracts. The people earn 2 to 3 times what a teacher does, the average teacher does. And then you can't even get rid of them because if there's budget crunches, because they're on 2-year contracts. So unless we get a grasp on where the money is being spent and put it back into people who directly impact the lives of kids, we're not going to see much of a change.
Camille, thank you for your call and your observation. Alexandra, what do you see there?
Oh, I agree with that 100%. It's called central office bloat. People say, oh, well, we don't have any more money for the schools. Yes, we do. It's just that superintendents and district officials are putting the money into more district official positions, extra chiefs of staff, extra, assistant director of something or other. And Camille's exactly right. And they don't have anything to do with the students. They don't have anything to do directly in schools. And they make 6-figure salaries. It's ridiculous. Yeah, we have the money. It just shouldn't be going to the central office. It should be going to the teachers.
And as you detail in the teachers, it's when Miguel gets an aide in his classroom that seems to turn the entire school year around, even the students.
Yeah, Miguel was getting assaulted in his classroom on a daily basis. He was bitten, he was punched, he was hit. This was the year before I followed him. That happened. And he kept complaining to the district saying, you keep sending me these moderately to severely disabled students, but you're not sending me any assistance. And I can't do this all by myself. And they kept saying, no, you're fine. No, you're fine. Then the district official in charge of assistance came to the school and he showed her the bite marks up and down his arm. And she shrugged and she said, well, that's just part of the job. Well, no, it's not. Yeah. It should not be part of the job.
Where else would that be part of the job except for maybe
exactly.
Mixed martial arts? I don't know outside of that, but there's no biting in mixed martial arts.
I hope not.
So one of the things you challenge in your book, Alexandra, is teacher burnout. And you provide a bigger perspective and say in some context, teacher burnout's a myth. Explain that.
Teacher burnout is a myth because, okay, so the phrase teacher burnout is a way of talking about exhaustion from overwork. It's misleading because experts say that the burnout for teachers is caused by inadequate workplace support and resources, high stakes testing, stuff like that. But instead of fixing these issues like any normal workplace would do, districts often say, well, the teacher should just do a better job of, and I'm air quoting here, self-care, as if it's on them to relieve the stress caused by a job that's impossible to do. So I say teacher burnout is a myth. The feelings that teachers have are extremely valid and they're going through this. However, it's not their fault. Instead of saying things like, oh, well, teachers have the highest burnout levels, we should be saying, no, school systems are the employer's worst at providing employees with necessary supports and resources.
Alexandra, thank you so much for joining us today, and thank you for your new book.
Thank you. Thank you for having me.
Alexandra Robbins is an author of 5 New York Times bestselling books and a Goodreads nonfiction book of the year. We were talking to her today about her book just out yesterday. It's called The Teachers, A Year Inside America's Most Vulnerable, Important Profession. Now, coming up after the news, an economist joins us to look at the state of banking in the U.S. after the federal government seized 2 financial institutions in the 2nd and 3rd largest bank collapses in U.S. history over the weekend. What's next? Stay tuned. I'm Lee Rayburn, and this is Central Time on the Ideas Network. This is Central Time. I'm Lee Rayburn in for Rob Ferret today. And coming up, is there any chance Aaron Rodgers will be returning to the Green Bay Packers next season? We'll have the very latest on the future of the green and gold and their longtime MVP quarterback. But first, the federal government seized 2 financial institutions over the weekend as Silicon Valley Bank and New York Signature Bank both collapsed. The FDIC says it will insure all deposits in the banks, even above the normal $250,000 limit on insured deposits. On Monday, President Biden tried to reassure the public that the cost of this action will not be directly passed on to them.
No losses will be borne by the taxpayers. Instead, the money will come from the fees that banks pay into the deposit insurance fund. Because of the actions that our regulators have already taken, every American should feel confident that their deposits will be there if and when they need them.
The Biden administration has avoided calling it a bailout for these banks, but some financial analysts wonder if the White House is setting a new precedent by insuring deposits above the $250,000 mark set by the FDIC. We're learning more about what led to these bank collapses and what Biden's response means for fiscal policy moving forward, and we welcome you to the conversation at 1-800-642-1234. What questions do you have about the government seizing these collapsed banks? Do you agree with the Biden administration's decision to insure bank deposits above the $250,000 limit? And are you concerned with the precedent that this might set? Join us, 1-800-642-1234, or email us, ideas@wpr.org. Our guest is James M. Murray, professor of economics at UW La Crosse. He teaches about macroeconomics, money, and banking. James, welcome to Central Time.
Thanks for having me. It's good to be here.
Let's start with what happened. What happened last week to Silicon Valley Bank and Signature Bank? Why did they collapse?
Well, there were bank runs on both of those institutions, and no bank, healthy or not, can survive a bank run. Banks take our deposits. They keep a small fraction of them on reserve, ready for us when we need them. And depositors can ask for their funds without notice as much as we want, whenever we want. But banks don't hold all of our money in reserves. They loan out a large fraction of that. And then the other thing that they do with our funds is they invest it in pretty liquid assets like treasury bills. Liquid means you can convert it quickly to cash to meet your depositors' needs if you want to. But treasury bonds, it's when the U.S. government goes into debt. They sell these promises to make those future cash flows. Those are assets held by the bank, and they can earn some interest if the bank doesn't need to sell those off. But there were runs on these financial institutions, and there were really three reasons. Now, FDIC ensures that your deposits are covered, even if a bank should fail. If all of the deposits were covered, then there shouldn't have been a bank run. But these two banks were unique in that only about 10% of their total deposits, at least that's for Signature, Silicon Valley Bank was similar. A very small fraction of those total deposits were actually insured because they have so many commercial clients, businesses, medium-sized businesses that need to make payrolls every 2 weeks, every month, whatever that might be, that were keeping balances much, much higher than that $250,000. And then the other thing that happened is the assets that were being held by these banks, now the commercial loans, the mortgages, those assets that those loans that the banks make, those aren't liquid at all. The liquid assets, so those treasury bills, those have been declining in value if you're going to sell them on a secondary market. Now, if you hold them to maturity, if you have a five-year bond and the bank wants to hold it for 5 years and collect those cash flows from the United States Treasury, there's no risk whatsoever. But if you need to sell those bonds in order to meet your depositors' needs, what's happened lately with interest rates increasing as the Fed has been trying to fight inflation, bond prices fall. And so the value of those bonds have fallen. And so it's become more difficult for these banks to meet their depositors' needs.
Well, James, let me stop you there because I'm curious about that federal interest rate is one of the reasons I saw people saying this was the start of the bank run is that these banks were kind of tied up in U.S. Treasury bonds, weren't liquid, and interest rates
liquid,
but they interest rates were making these banks investments challenge. So what role did the Federal Reserve's interest rate hikes play in these banks? And if it played a role in these banks going under, how come it has not infected other banks as of yet?
No, good question. So this is, it's also been quite predictable that the reason the Fed is raising interest rates is to try to increase the cost of borrowing, kind of bring down spending in order to try to reduce demand and bring down inflation, because inflation has been a problem. Whenever we see high inflation, we should see the Fed responding by increases in interest rates. And the Fed's been clear about their intentions on raising interest rates. Next week on Wednesday, I bet you you'll see a statement by the Fed that they're increasing interest rates by another quarter of a percentage point. This is affecting absolutely every bank in the country. And this is not the first time that the Fed has raised interest rates either. So this is quite predictable and widespread. So that can't be the only story. The last part of the story was that Signature Valley Bank, for example, was very specialized. Most of their depositors and their loans were a very large fraction of their depositors and loans were venture capital funded small to medium sized startup companies in the tech industry and in the health tech industry. And the tech industry in general has seen has been struggling lately. I think Facebook just announced another round of layoffs just yesterday. Google's announced layoffs. Microsoft's announced layoffs. And I'm sure those smaller companies in the tech industry are hurting too. And so what that means is for when these smaller tech companies are also hurting, they're probably drawing down their deposits. And so these two financial institutions are actually seeing higher demands on their deposits than probably most banks around the country. So we have that problem. We have the problem that most of their deposits are not actually FDIC insured. Mm-hmm. And we have the problem that the most liquid assets that the banks could have to sell to meet their depositors' needs are also losing value.
James Murray, our guest, professor of economics at UW La Crosse. We invite you to the conversation at 1-800-642-1234 or email ideas@wpr.org. What did you think about the second and third largest bank failures in U.S. history over the weekend? What did you think about the Biden administration's intent to step in and help them above the $250,000 limit that the Federal Deposit Insurance Corporation had generally stuck to? And I 1-800-642-1234 if you'd like to join us. But I'll ask you, James, what precedent this sets when the federal government's willing to go above and beyond the FDIC in covering depositors of these two banks that went under. They still don't want to call it a bailout, but is it?
Well, so bailout's not a very precisely defined term. So we could easily have an argue about that depending on our definition. I would say in many respects, it's not a bailout. And that is Signature Bank and Silicon Valley Bank. They failed. The owners, the shareholders of those firms, they lost their money. They lost a lot of their money. And the employees are going to be losing their jobs. Management has already lost their jobs. So they'd made mistakes and they're paying for it. So they were for sure not bailed out. So who was quote unquote bailed out? Who was bailed out were the clients of the bank, the customers of the bank. It could be depositors like you and me, but also they especially serviced a lot of venture funded small to medium sized businesses. So it was those businesses in the tech industry and the health industry that were using Signature Valley Bank, not as an investment tool, but really as just a service for providing transaction services, depositing their revenues and then cutting paychecks for payrolls. And so it was those institutions whose deposits are guaranteed. So they're seeing relief. They can meet payrolls this week. Yeah. Because Sunday night, Monday morning, that was a significant question about whether these small businesses would be able to meet their payroll obligations for this week.
And for many, the 15th would be payday. And let's go to your questions now and comments about these banks going under and what's next for our fiscal policy going forward at 1-800-642-1234 with our guest, James Murray, professor of economics at UW La Crosse. Greg and Rhinelander, you're on the air.
Yeah, is that Rick and Rhinelander?
I'm sorry. Did you say I've got Greg here, but you can be whoever you want to be.
Okay, I'll be Rick. So I have two questions for your guests, and thank you for taking my call. The first is during the Trump administration, part of Dodd-Frank was rolled back significantly. The capital requirements for banks, that is the fraction of reserve that they keep, to prevent having to have this kind of problem, and more importantly, the stress tests that were they would evaluate, well, what would happen if interest rates went up, or what would happen if we're in a concentrated, non-diversified situation like these banks are, where all their clients are in one sector of the economy. I'm interested in that, and I'm also interested in the question of moral hazard, whereas if we now bail out any depositor above $250,000, what is to prevent the banks from taking extreme risks? There's no, as long as the government's going to backstop everything, there's no reason to even consider risk management. So I'm interested in those two areas.
Great questions, Rick. Appreciate the call. And let's start with the rollback of regulations in 2018. Did that play a role here as you see it, James?
That wasn't the major role here, because these banks as of a few months ago, they had positive net worths. These banks were holding treasury bills, bonds, fairly liquid assets to meet their to be able to meet their depositors' needs. So they were. I didn't look into the full financial details of these banks, but the problem wasn't that they were that there were inadequate capital requirements. The problem was is the declining values. I'm not saying there wasn't mismanagement. There was mismanagement. This was quite predictable that interest rates would be rising, and therefore the value of those bonds that the banks are holding as part of their assets to meet the depositors' needs, those are declining in value. That was quite predictable. That risk was inadequately addressed. But I don't see it as a problem with the rollbacks of the requirements.
And what about the moral hazards of the
right
and going forward, James?
So a moral hazard problem in general is when you, whenever you take any kind of risky action, if you take some risky action, if there's a big payout, you get your big payout. If there's a big loss, somebody bails you out and somebody else's problem. And then that just, if that's going to be the case every time, or there's an expectation that'll be the case the next time, then you're going to have this problem of banks taking on too much risk. So I do not think there's a moral hazard with the financial institutions. And the reason I don't is because the banks themselves were not bailed out. Signature Valley Bank was seized by the federal government. All its assets are going to be sold. The equity holders are going to be out all of their money. So a lot of people are going to lose their money. These are the owners of the banks. So they for sure are realizing the consequences of their actions. The ones who are quote unquote bailed out or the ones that are assisted here are the customers. So where there might be a moral hazard problem though, is if you're say a wealthy individual and you know, I don't have this problem. If you're a wealthy individual that has balances and checking accounts of several million dollars, you know, something that exceeds $250,000, you might fail to, you know, diversify your portfolio of just where you put your deposit accounts. Maybe make sure that you have a larger fraction of your financial wealth insured that way. So there's the potential there. But as far as moral hazard with the financial institutions, I don't see it because these banks failed.
We're talking about bank collapses and federal fiscal policy with UW-La Crosse economics professor James Murray. And you can join us at 1-800-642-1234. Did the two bank collapses cause concern for you and your money? And what do you see going forward after the Biden administration eased concerns earlier this week for depositors of those two banks? Join us, 1-800-642-1234. Our conversation continues here on Central Time. You're listening to Central Time on the Ideas Network. I'm Lee Rayburn, and we're picking up our talk with James Murray. He's an economics professor at UW-La Crosse, here today to look at the collapses of Silicon Valley Bank and Signature Bank and the response so far from the federal government. And you can join the conversation at 1-800-642-1234 or email us ideas@wpr.org. Let's go back to your questions now. We'll go to Gail in Fish Creek. Gail, good afternoon.
Hi, thanks for taking my call. Yeah, I've been watching this on several fronts. My question is kind of, there's one question and a comment, that I was looking at whether they were, how much they were into, invested into crypto and where that all is, and with the meltdown that FTX took, if they were connected in that. And that may have caused big money investors to be pulling out, which all it would take is a couple of the big ones, the whopper whale investors, to pull out, and that would leave the whole bank vulnerable. But then Signature Bank had Barney Frank on the board. And if anybody remembers him from the Fannie Mae and Freddie Mac and the mortgage meltdown issue that happened with the Glass-Steagall and all, he was... his fingers were all over that. So I'm wondering why anybody would hire him, and he was connected with Signature. So what's going on with the crypto with those two banks?
Yeah, thank you, Gail. And what is the role that crypto plays in the failure of Silicon Valley Bank and Signature Bank, James?
Signature Bank they specialized in transaction services to crypto startups. So they weren't providing services and for the cryptocurrency itself. They were providing financial services for companies that were involved in cryptocurrency. 27% of the assets at Signature Bank, 27% of the clients were digital asset or crypto clients. So, and like the tech industry, the crypto, maybe not for the same reasons, but what those two industries have in common is the crypto industry has lately been suffering, and that was a big reason also behind the collapse of Signature Bank, that its clients, its loans were, some of its loans may have been in default or higher levels of default because they were crypto companies, and then those commercial clients that had deposit accounts, they likely had to draw down their deposit some, and then for the same reason as Silicon Valley Bank, let's see, Signature Bank had only 10% of its deposits FDIC insured, and so they weren't, most of its deposits weren't insured. The value of its liquid assets had fallen with higher interest rates, and just like Silicon Valley Bank, they found they were not able to meet their depositors' needs.
And what about Barney Frank?
Played a role.
Yeah, James, Barney Frank, I mean, the Dodd-Frank legislation following the 2008 subprime mortgage crisis and financial crisis. I mean, it's named, he's got his name right on it, but Gail mentions Barney Frank as one of the people involved in Signature Bank. And from Politico the other day, Barney Frank says he blames the crypto panic for his bank's collapse.
Okay.
you don't fine. See it that way.
If you're if you're a Signature Bank that doesn't, you know, you don't have a very diverse portfolio of customers and heavy in crypto, I don't care if you're heavy in crypto and or heavy in bananas. If there's going to if the banana industry or the crypto industry or the tech industry or whatever you might have too many eggs in that basket collapses, then your bank's going to be in a difficult situation. So
yeah, one of the other reasons that I have seen blamed for these banks going under, and specifically from Florida Governor Ron DeSantis, is wokeism, the ESG initiatives, environment, social, and government initiatives of these banks. Do you see that playing a role?
No, the problem here seems to be pretty specific about a non-diverse customer base that has started to draw down their deposits. So very specific industries here, the tech industry and the crypto industry. I don't know how wokeism comes into play there, but it's the combination of two industries that are suffering right now, that these banks happen to be specializing in, at the same time as interest rates going up and the value of those bonds that the banks are holding going down, at the same time as having, and this is about being non-diverse, also non-diverse customers also. I mean diverse in terms of the types of industries and the wealth of the customers, having a very small percentage of your deposits actually FDIC insured. That's why we had runs on the banks. If we had a high fraction of those deposits FDIC insured, even if people thought the banks were going to collapse, there wouldn't be a worry. There wouldn't be a bank run on them because you would still feel secure in your deposits.
Well, and I want to ask, James, if this is potentially contagious. I see this morning that the Credit Suisse Bank shares fell more than 25% in today's trading, at least at last check. Is there a threat of contagion here among banks? And we got about a minute left.
Okay. Bank stocks around both sides of the Atlantic seem to have been falling. I won't put too much interpretation on what's happening with stock prices that could rebound tomorrow. Whatever's going on the other side of the Atlantic doesn't seem to be the same issue. What's in common though are very large depositors, very wealthy depositors over there. There's a potential for contagion if people just start not trusting their bank. Like I said, even healthy banks, not a single bank can around the world can survive a bank run without being bailed out or insured or something like that.
James,
so it's it is about confidence.
We'll have to leave it there for today, but I thank you so much for joining us.
Perfect. All right. Thank you very much.
Thank you. James Murray, professor of economics at UW La Crosse, with us today to discuss the FDIC seizing Silicon Valley Bank and Signature Bank after they collapsed and how this shapes fiscal policy as it continues to move forward. Buy me some peanuts and a double shot espresso. I don't care if I never get back. The World Baseball Classic's underway, and the USA will be playing for a chance to make it to the quarterfinals tonight as they compete against Colombia at Arizona's Chase Field. But balls and strikes aren't what's grabbing all the headlines. The Italian baseball team has installed an espresso machine in their dugout. Italy's manager and 12-time Major League All-Star Mike Piazza says the worst part is having to drink his espresso out of a paper cup. It's kind of a sacrilege, Piazza said, but when it's the only option you have to deal with it. Maybe next time we'll bring the metallic machine with the copper eagle on the top and someone in there knocking espressos out. Italy's team's already made it to the World Baseball Classic's quarterfinals, and you have to wonder if this new sports energy drink might just catch on. In addition to a bat boy in the dugout, how long before teams have their own barista at the old ball game? I'm Lee Rayburn, and this is Central Time.